This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Spec Ops, Book 2 of Expeditionary Force, written by Craig Allenson, performed by R.C. Bray. Chapter 1. The Flying Dutchman shuddered again with sounds of groaning and the terrifying shriek of metal composites being torn apart. The displays on the bridge flickered, and the air was filled with alarm bells and klaxons from almost every system. "Skippy, get us out of—" The ship shook violently again. "Direct hit on number 4 reactor," Skippy announced calmly. "Reactor has lost containment. I am preparing it for ejection. Ejection system is offline. Pilot, portside thrusters, full emergency thrust on my mark."
"Ready,"
Desai acknowledged in as calm a voice as she could manage.
"Mark, go!"
Skippy shouted.
Whatever they were doing, it was more than the ship's already stressed artificial gravity and inertial compensation systems could handle. Normally, ship maneuvers were not felt at all by the crew. This time, I lurched in the command chair and had to hang on as the ship was flung to the right. There was a shudder, actually a wave of ripples traveling along the ship's spine, accompanied by a deep harmonic groaning. No ship should ever make a sound like that.
"Ah, damn it. Reactor 4 is away. It impacted Reactor 2 on the way out, shutting down 2 now."
Skippy's voice had a touch of strain to it.
"Missiles inbound, diverting all remaining power to jump drive capacitors. Hang on. This is going to be close."
The main display indicated the jump drive was at 38% charge. Skippy had told us that with the Dutchman trapped inside the Theranan Destroyer Squadron's damping field, we needed a 42% charge for even a short jump, and that still carried a severe risk of rupturing the drive.
If that happened, then we would never know it. We'd simply be dead between one picosecond and another.
The missile symbols on the display, 7 of them, were coming in fast. 2 of the symbols disappeared as I watched, destroyed by our ship's point defense maser beams. The other 5 missiles continued toward us, fast, fuzzing our sensors with their stealth fields and weaving as they bored in. 1 more missile destroyed, 4 still moving fast. Jump drive at 40%. Too close. I turned the knob to release the plastic cover over the self-destruct button and turned to look through the glass wall into the CIC compartment.
"Colonel Chang."
He nodded, and I saw him flip back the cover to the other self-destruct button, the confirmation.
"Sir."
He looked me straight in the eye and saluted. I returned the salute.
"Colonel Chang, we have been down a long, strange road together. It's been an honor serving with you."
My left thumb hovered over the self-destruct button. The ship was dying anyway. This was my fault. How the hell had I gotten us into this mess? I'd better start at the beginning. My name is Joe Bishop. I'm a sergeant, temporarily holding the theater rank of colonel in the United States Army. Neither rank matters much at the moment, since I'm aboard a stolen alien starship over 1,000 light-years from Earth. Believe it or not, the United Nations Expeditionary Force has put me in command of our ship, a Theranan star carrier we unwisely named the Flying Dutchman. I have, I think, good common sense, and everyone else would agree, a history of getting into trouble. Big trouble. And a history of getting out of trouble. If you ask me, I've been in the right places at the wrong times. My critics would say that I am one lucky son of a bitch. My mother is not a bitch, but other than that, they may have a point. Skippy, our ancient alien-talking beer-can combination mascot and artificial superintelligence, says there is no such thing as luck, that humans believe in luck because our dumb monkey-level linear thinking has no idea how the universe works. Whatever. When the Flying Dutchman went outbound through the wormhole near Earth, and Skippy shut down the wormhole behind us, I have to admit a tiny, tiny part of me was disappointed that the ship didn't immediately explode into a bazillion pieces. One of our cargo holds has 12 tactical nukes from the American inventory. We only need nuke 1 to vaporize the ship and erase all trace that humans were roaming the galaxy, but somebody had a coupon, or they were cheaper by the dozen at Nukes R Us or something, so we had 11 extra. No, they aren't available as last-minute birthday gifts, thanks for asking. When Skippy confirmed the wormhole had been shut down behind us, deactivated at this time, not merely temporarily disrupted its connection to the network or whatever, a tiny part of me hoped that UNEF had somehow snuck behind Skippy's back and set a nuke to explode right then.
You ever been on a cliff or the balcony of a really tall building and you look over the edge with butterflies in your stomach and you're afraid of falling, but a tiny part of you wants to jump? A tiny part of you that you're afraid you won't be able to control wants to jump. You're afraid of being near the edge because you think you might not be able to control yourself, that you might feel compelled to jump. I read somewhere that it's because part of your brain can't stand the tension and wants the tension to just go away, even if the solution kills you. No? Never had that happen to you? Hey, I'm afraid of heights. That's why I never signed up for Army parachute training. Flying in a Black Hawk helo with the door open hadn't bothered me much. As long as I could hear the engines howling above my head, I figured we'd be all right. Being on my parents' house roof, stringing Christmas lights, now that kind of thing scared the hell out of me. Scared me enough that every February I had argued with my mother against taking the lights down. Why go through the trouble of taking them down? I asked. Sure, most of the year our neighbors would grumble that the Bishop family were lazy procrastinators, but by October, maybe November, we'd begin to look like proactive geniuses, right? And my mother never fell for that argument. The Christmas lights were always down by Super Bowl weekend. In this case, it wasn't heights I was afraid of. My fear was of the unknown, of being responsible for all the people aboard the ship, and if one of my screw-ups meant our enemies discovered humans had stolen the Theran and Star Carrier, of me being responsible for the destruction of humanity. If the Dutchman had exploded beyond my control, I wouldn't have to be concerned about my inevitable screw-ups. UNEF hadn't set a nuke to explode. Or they did, and Skippy, of course, discovered their plan and stopped it. It would have been easier for everyone if the Dutchman had become a rapidly expanding sphere of subatomic particles. Either way, we were still alive, and I had to continue the mission as planned. Dawn. If the Dutchman had exploded, it would have killed 70 people. Our new, not-so-merry band of pirates was 58 military personnel and a dozen civilian scientists. This time, we were semi-officially a merry band of pirates. Everyone had on their uniform the Paramecium with eye patch logo that Skippy designed for us. Even the scientists were given a patch on their official mission jackets. So far, I hadn't seen many of the scientists wearing those jackets, and I wasn't going to make an issue of it. Scientists, civilians, didn't worry me. What did concern me is that this time, the military units assigned to the Dutchman were from Spec Ops units, elite special forces troops and hotshot pilots. By the way, when I left Earth the first time, I'd been current on military slang, at least U.S. military slang, but apparently I was the only one who didn't know people on Earth were pronouncing the United Nations Expeditionary Force UNEF. And this is before we even left. This whole time I've been wasting precious light years spelling it out, UNEF. Skippy probably had a minor beer can meltdown. Although in my defense, Skippy in his absent-minded way dropped the ball plenty of times his absent-minded self. So where was I? Right, UNEF. After we left, governments had wanted to emphasize the glorious contributions of their own armed forces to fighting the horrible Ruha, so they'd stopped mentioning the UN part of UNEF and just called us the Expeditionary Force, or X-4. The name X-4 sounded cool and it stuck. A bit later, when people and their governments began to regret the alliance with the Kristang, the governments in UNEF tried to emphasize again the United Nations part, as if the governments that were part of UNEF had no responsibility for what had happened. By that time it was too late. X-4 had stuck in the public's mind. The mission was technically under the command of the United Nations Expeditionary Force Special Operations Command Directorate. Yeah, that's a mouthful to say. And in reality, I was in command all by myself, because as soon as the Dutchman jumped away from Earth orbit, we were on our own. If things went well, UNEF SOCOM would take credit. If things went sideways, they would heap the blame on me. That's the way it works. When Special Operations Command assigned our crew, I first called the new merry band of pirates SOCOM. Then I quickly learned all the cool kids used the term Spec Ops. Although when I, a soldier who had never been in a special operations unit, tried to be a cool kid by saying Spec Ops, I got some weird looks. I was learning. Let me explain about Spec Ops, or Special Forces Troops. My knowledge comes from observing, and certainly not from experience. Whether they are U.S. Navy SEALs, U.S. Army Rangers, British SAS, or in any other military service on Earth, Spec Ops soldiers are all badasses and they know it. Getting into Special Forces units requires incredible commitment to meet tough physical standards and, much more importantly, mental toughness. You know those guys or girls in high school, or even before that, who already knew exactly what they wanted to do in life? And they were completely focused, in great physical shape, getting up at 5 a.m. for swimming or hockey practice or running or lifting weights before school. They got good grades, studied hard, never slacked off. The adults always liked them. They were great athletes, intense even in practices. Most importantly, they were serious. Serious about life, even as young teenagers, at a time when most of us were drifting along or flailing through life, having no idea what we wanted. Those guys and girls? They are where Spec Ops troops come from. They're better than most of us, certainly better than me. I am a reasonably dedicated soldier, proud to wear the uniform. No way could I qualify for Special Forces. The physical stuff I could train myself up to do, I'm pretty sure. The difference is, I would never want to train that hard. I don't have the internal discipline or the drive to work that hard. I simply don't have enough desire to do it. I greatly admire the people who do make that level of commitment, and I'm glad I don't have to. Special Forces are the best of the best, and the Dutchmen got the best people from Special Operations Commands of the Five Nations in UNEF. I couldn't imagine the competition that had gone on for slots aboard the Dutchman. The only thing I was sure of is that I would never have qualified. Our new merry band of pirates completely intimidated me. They were tougher than me, smarter than me, more dedicated, more driven, better soldiers and human beings in almost every way I could think of. And I was in command of these superhumans. Me. I wasn't worthy. They knew it. I knew it. Part of being officially in command of an actual UNEF mission, instead of being the do-it-yourself leader of a pirate ship, was the mountains of official paperwork, even if paper had been replaced by iPads. I hated it. I had never been good at dealing with boring details. "Joe," Skippy said to me while I was in my office the day after we left the wormhole behind, trying to deal with the tedious administrative details of being a commander. "I have a question for you. Technically, a complaint." I write it on a piece of paper and put it in the suggestion box. "We have a suggestion box?" he asked, sounding genuinely surprised. "Yep, it's in the closest black hole. Just drop it in and wait." "Oh, very funny, Joey. A black hole will get you the same result as a suggestion box, so all right, I get the message. Anyway, I was looking at the crew roster database on your iPad." "Oh, man, don't remind me. Please, I've got enough of this damned administrivia to deal with already." "This is an easy one, Joe. I notice there's no entry for me in the crew roster. I'm not even listed as a passenger, and I'm clearly crucial to the proper operation of the ship. I should be listed as part of the crew." "I'm sorry, Skippy, I didn't know you cared." Damn, our super powerful alien AI was sensitive about the oddest things. He hated it when he was considered differently than any other sentient being aboard the ship. "You're right. That's my fault. I'll input your data right now." "Oh, and I see you've already helpfully pulled up the input screen on my iPad for me. Did you save the report I spent the last 20 minutes writing?" "Like humanity needs to read that mindless drivel. I'd be doing monkey kind of favor by erasing that crap." "Sure, it's, saved. And it better be. I already forgot what the hell I wrote in that report." "First item in the crew roster is given name, so I'll input Skippy. Second item is surname, The Magnificent." "Really? It is entirely appropriate, Joe." "Oh, uh-huh. Because that's what everyone calls you," I retorted sarcastically, rolling my eyes. Not wanting to argue with him, I typed in The Magnificent. "Next question is your rank. This file is designed for military personnel. I'd like Grand Exalted Field Marshal El Supremo." "Right, I'll type in Cub Scout. Next question." "Hey, you jerk. Is occupational specialty." "Oh, clearly that should be Lord God Controller of all things." "I'll give you that one. That is spelled A-S-S-H-O-L-E. Next." "Hey, you shithead. I should..." "Age?" I asked. "Well, a couple million at least, I think. Mentally, you're a 6-year-old, so that's what I typed in." "Joe, I just changed your rank in the personnel file to Big Poopy Head." Skippy laughed. 5-year-old. You're a 5-year-old. I guess that's fair," he admitted. "Sex," I'm going to select N.A. on that one for you, I said. Joe, in your personnel file, I just updated sex to unlikely.
This is not going well, Skippy.
You started it.
Oh, that was mature.
Four-year-old, then. Maybe terrible twos.
I give up, Skippy snorted. Save the damn files and we'll call it even, okay?
No problem. We should do this more often, huh?
Oh, shut up.
I thought that was the end of it. Until 5 minutes later when Sergeant Adams called me.
Sir, I'm looking at the crew training roster, and Skippy is now listed as asshole first class?
Ah, damn it. I hadn't thought anyone would look at the stupid roster.
I'll change the darn thing.
No need, sir. It certainly describes him.
Adams laughed.
Yeah, that it does.
Also, the required training schedule under your name now lists potty training. I thought you should know. Also, it says you need to learn about the birds and the bees.
Ah, crap.
Skippy and I had a talk a few minutes ago. It looks like I need another one.
You think that's going to change anything? She asked skeptically.
Not really.
It wasn't only me. Every one of the original merry band of pirates was intimidated by our new all-star crew. The second night after we left the now deactivated wormhole behind, I'd gone into the galley at 4 a.m., unable to sleep, wanting a cup of coffee and some human company. Before getting dressed, I checked my iPad for the uniform of the day posted by Colonel Chang as the ship's executive officer. Most days we wore camis, and on Mondays we would be wearing dress uniforms to dinner. Today was the standard summer service uniform, or whatever each country's military had as the equivalent. When I got to the galley, to my surprise, I found Lieutenant Colonel Chang, Major Sims, Captain Giroux, and Captain Desai sitting at a table, bleary-eyed and drinking coffee. After I poured a cup for myself, Sergeant Adams walked in, and I handed a cup to her. There we were, the six of us, alone in the galley, the six members of the original merry band of pirates who were still aboard the ship. We'd been through so much together, so much we hadn't expected to survive, that I felt like hugging them all. I refrained because Sergeant Adams would have punched me if I tried to hug her. Instead, I bumped fists with Adams and handed her a cup of coffee.
"This is a coincidence," I observed.
"For you, sir, maybe," Adams replied, sitting down across from Giroux. "My duty shift starts in an hour."
"Mine also," Sims said over a mouthful of coffee.
"I couldn't sleep," Chang said simply.
"Same here," I said.
I sat down next to Desai and raised my cup for a toast.
"To the original merry band of pirates, especially those who didn't make it home." Coffee cups clinked together and we all drank. The cups didn't actually make a clinking sound as they were plastic, but they had the official UNEF logo on one side and UNS Flying Dutchman on the other. If by some total freaking miracle we ever returned to Earth, I could definitely see these plastic cups getting smuggled off the ship and becoming a much-prized collector's item. The six of us started catching up, because most of us didn't see much of each other between the time we left the Dutchman and the few days before departure from Earth orbit. And none of us had time to talk much during those frantic days of loading and preparing the ship after the government on Earth had finally made the forehead smackingly obvious decision to send the Dutchman back out. Every single survivor of the original merry band of pirates had volunteered to take the Dutchman back out again. After a lot of discussion, argument, and thinking, and a whole lot of politics among the governments involved, I had only accepted the five sitting with me in the galley. Although all the survivors volunteered to take the Dutchman back out, they didn't all need to come with us, and their governments were keen on having some of them remain on Earth for the knowledge they had. Many of the survivors had injuries. Giroux still had his arm encased in a Theranin healing sleeve, and Chang's ribs were still tender. Dr. Skippy's prognosis was for Giroux to have his arm out of the sleeve and fully healed in 2 more days. That was not soon enough for the French paratrooper, because he said his arm itched like 1,000 ants were biting him. Skippy said that was all in Giroux's head. This trip, I firmly believed, was a fool's errand, a suicide mission. The original merry band of pirates had pushed their luck to the limit already. To expect more from them was crazy. I'd been forced to argue using, let's say, strong language with Sergeant Adams, trying to persuade her not to come with us. She didn't have anything to prove, I told her. She had sacrificed enough. What I didn't say was that although we'd both been prisoners of the Kristang and scheduled to be executed, she had also been tortured. I'd seen her scars.
Man, she laid into me for that, practically shouting that I was only saying that because she is a woman,
that if she was a male Marine, I wouldn't pamper her. She was wrong about that. She also hadn't let me get a word in while she berated me.
With all due respect, sir, you wear Colonel's Eagles, but we both know you're a buck sergeant. You need me.
She had been right, 100%, and I was damn glad to have her. I was glad to have all of them, people I knew and trusted. Our new crew were all stars, to be sure. There were also people I didn't know. Before launch, I had deliberately avoided gathering just the six of us, as I didn't want the rest of the crew to think I favored my old comrades, although, of course, I did. There were other pilots aboard with vastly greater experience and qualifications than Captain Desai, pilots who had flown the hottest jets, test pilots, top guns. And not a single one of them were allowed to touch a single button of the Dutchman's controls unless they were under Desai's supervision. Any one of them might be able to be trusted to pilot an alien starship. Desai was trusted. Skippy felt the same way. Regardless of each pilot's official call sign before they came aboard the Flying Dutchman, Skippy began by calling all of them Fing, or fucking new guy, or girl. We had to explain to the new pilots that Skippy was actually being pretty nice considering, you know, Skippy. One pilot, who I won't name, pissed Skippy off enough that his new assigned quarters were an airlock. That required me to intervene, although I could see Skippy's point. That pilot's new call sign instantly became Alligator for Airlock Guy. It's a pilot thing. What do you think of the new crew? I asked to no one in particular. Chang spoke first after diplomatically taking a pause to sip coffee.
It will be an interesting exercise in international cooperation.
Giraud nodded, then shrugged.
We will see.
70 people aboard the ship. 12 of them were scientists, civilians. Of those, 7 were women and 5 men. Their specialties covered everything from medicine and biology to physics. Competition for a berth aboard the Dutchman had been fierce among scientists, a bit less so after I explained that I did not realistically expect us to ever return. If it had been entirely up to me, we would have taken 0 scientists along. We didn't need scientists to achieve the mission objectives, and they would be only more people dead if we couldn't return to Earth. The number of people in our new merry band of pirates had not been my decision to make. Governments around the globe had insisted we bring scientists along. The original list had several thousand names on it. Limiting us to 12 scientists had been the best compromise I could get. My final criteria for who came with us and who stayed home was less about pure scientific ability and more about ability to get along with other people. What we did not need was a bunch of genius brainiacs, or as Skippy referred to them, slightly smarter monkeys, who had massive egos and became a pain in the ass during a long trip aboard the Dutchman. That was part of the reason we had more women scientists than men. Too many of the male candidates had failed UNEF's get-along-well-with-others psychological tests.
International cooperation, I repeated the phrase slowly. Our original crew cooperated well, I pointed out.
We had to, Chang said, and our mission then was to rescue Earth. We were all highly motivated.
Our crew back then was whoever was available right there, Giraud pointed out. I was only at the logistics base because my commander sent me to find out why supplies were so slow getting to us.
We sent what we had at the time, Sim said defensively.
Giraud nodded.
Yes, I realized that when I got there, Major. My point, Colonel, is our original crew had a sense of great purpose. We were thrown together, unexpectedly, to rescue our entire planet. Our new crew has no such sense of purpose.
And the special forces all think they are special, Adams remarked sourly over her coffee.
No offense, sir, she added to Giraud.
None taken, he laughed. Some of them intimidate me, he admitted.
And René Giraud had been an elite French paratrooper even before he went to paradise.
You too? I asked. They all intimidate me.
My concern is these rivalries may get out of hand.
Rivalries not only between nationalities. I also had to worry about how U.S. Army Rangers and Navy SEALs would get along. Professionally, I hoped.
Adams bumped fists with Giraud across the table.
Don't worry, sir. We'll get them straightened out.
Chang had assigned the experienced Giraud and Adams to get our new Special Forces unit squared away and to set up a training regimen. The new people had to learn about the Dutchman, the flower, and dropships for basics. Then they would move on to familiarizing themselves with Krestang-powered armor and combats. What I was really worried about was our elite, gung-ho, intense special forces troops becoming bored. Before we departed Earth orbit, I had assembled the entire off-duty crew and scientists in an empty cargo bay. I explained once again that my sincere hope was for us to see zero combat action, that we would see nothing interesting along the way. A successful mission, in my opinion, would be for us to find Skippy's magic radio, drop him off somewhere, and for the Dutchman to return uneventfully to Earth. Or, in the all-too-likely scenario of the Dutchman breaking down somewhere after Skippy left us, of us being stuck in interstellar space with food running low and me having to engage our self-destruct. When I told the crew that unpleasant fact, I could see Special Forces nodding grimly. I also saw in their eyes they didn't fully believe it. They were trained for action, and action is what they expected. I hoped to disappoint them. Our new mission continued to use the UN Expeditionary Force Command structure. The scientists came from many nations, but the military forces were drawn from only 5 countries: America, China, India, Britain, and France. Each country provided 9 Special Forces soldiers, except that America had only 4 Rangers and 4 SEALs because an American commanded the mission. Each country also provided 2 pilots. Giroux and Desai were in the Special Forces and pilot count. That left me, Chang, Sims, and Adams rounding out the 58 military personnel aboard. I drank the last of the coffee in my cup and got up for a refill. The coffee pot was almost empty. I drained the dregs into my cup and got the pot started on brewing more. There wasn't any breakfast available yet, other than do-it-yourself toast. Whose turn is it in the galley today? Details like that were Chang's decision as the executive officer. I should have known anyway. There was a duty roster somewhere, like on my Z-phone, that I was too lazy to look at. China, Chang replied. We'll get started in an hour or so. That's fine. I'm not hungry yet, I said. What was a Chinese breakfast like? I was eager to find out. Our crew was scientists, pilots, and special forces. We had no cooks, no mechanics, none of the usual support personnel. Each day, one nationality among the military forces would handle cooking in the galley, with the scientists making up a 6th team for cooking duties. The food situation was going to be interesting. Culinary skill had not been a prerequisite for assignment aboard the Flying Dutchman, although I knew we could count on the hyper-competitive special forces to do their best. With a fresh half-cup of coffee, I headed toward the door. I'm going to hit the gym, I announced. Getting there early hopefully meant I would be working out by myself without being surrounded by spec ops people who were all in better condition than I was. Maybe I needed to be concerned about my own ego, too. Chapter 2. When I was done working out in the gym, I needed a shower. It was a lung-burning, muscle-aching workout that left my legs like jelly and my arms shaky. Literally, my arms were so weary my hands were shaking. Even my fingers hurt. And the 6 Chinese Spec Ops guys who were in the gym while I was there had been doing a tougher workout. They were already well into their exercises before I got to the gym, and when I left, they were headed out of the gym to run sprints down the Dutchman's long spine corridor. I felt like collapsing. In the shower, I had to kneel down, because it was a Theranin-sized shower, and we hadn't been able to fix that when we refitted the Dutchman in Earth orbit. Beds had been lengthened to human size by cutting away cabinets we didn't need, but adjusting showers had not been on the priority list in the short time we had before our pirated star carrier had to depart. My shaky fingers missed the shower controls several times, and I cursed out loud. "Something wrong, Colonel Joe?" Skippy's voice had an undertone of genuine concern. "You seem especially clumsy this morning." "Especially? Well, thanks a lot, Skippy. I meant no offense. A clumsy monkey is a dead monkey, Joe. When you're swinging from trees in the jungle, the clumsy monkey falls and gets eaten by a leopard." "Ha!" I had to laugh at that. "Not many leopards in this part of the galaxy, Skippy. My arms are tired, that's all. I did a tough workout." "I know. I was watching you. Don't you think you were overdoing it a bit, Joe?" "Hell no. Those Spec Ops guys and the women, hell, especially the women, are super high speed, Skippy. Damn it, I'm in good shape, and I'm younger than most of them,
and they're kicking my ass already. I'd like to train with them, but the first time one of them throws me to the mat without breaking a sweat, I think I'd totally lose their respect.
Wow, you truly are a dumb monkey. How can anyone be so clueless? Joe, those Spec Ops people are completely intimidated by you. They have a huge chip on their shoulders about you, and about the other members of the original Merry Band of Pirates.
What? I sputtered under the cascading water. Give me a minute to rinse off. With a still shaky hand, I pressed the button to shut off the water and backed out to stand up carefully to reach for a towel.
How do you figure that? Those people have gone through the toughest military training there is. They're the best. They're all completely super confident.
Super confident about most things, probably, yes. About you? No.
Think about it from their point of view, Joe. When UNEF went off-world, they stayed behind. For one reason or another, they were left behind. They missed out on all the action. Right there, they all think they have something to prove to you, Chang, and the others.
Huh. I guess you're right, Skippy. I hadn't thought of that.
Well, that's just the beginning. You not only went off-world, you captured two alien starships, brought back priceless intel, and rescued your entire species from Kristang.
Joe, these Spec Ops people are completely in awe of you. You and all the original crew.
Yes, they have passed an extremely rigorous selection process that requires incredible physical and mental toughness, however.
What have they actually accomplished? What are the odds that, during their entire military careers, they will accomplish anything anywhere close to what you did?
The answer is about zero, Joe, and they all know it.
Joe, they all think you look down on them.
Crap. He was right. I had been utterly clueless. I'd been thinking only of myself, and not considering how the new crew might think of their situation. Back when I was in the U.S. Army 10th Mountain Infantry Division, and our battalion first went into Nigeria to boost the peacekeeping efforts in that region, I had been in awe of the guys in the battalion that was rotating out. They had been there. They had lived it. They knew the territory. They had been in combat. They'd done it, for real. I had only been briefed on it. And you could see it in their eyes, too. They knew that many of the guys in our battalion, including me, were green and had never carried a rifle in a hostile area. It made a difference. And when it was our battalion's turn to pull out and go home, we changed. All of us. We'd been there. We knew. The Spec Ops people now aboard the Flying Dutchman had not been there, had not been off-world, had likely never seen an alien in person. They'd been put through hell on Earth by the Kristang. I'd been spared that experience. Still, I had served in UNEF on Paradise, and they hadn't. Many Special Forces units had not made the trip to Paradise. The Kristang hadn't especially wanted them, and governments on Earth may have been hedging their bets, keeping most of their elite combat power close to home. At some point, if the Dutchman hadn't appeared in the sky for Skippy to stomp the Kristang like bugs, maybe the Spec Ops people would have at least tried to hit the Kristang. It would have been a futile gesture to attack the Kristang in their bunkers, and impossible to attack them aboard their ships in orbit. Any Spec Ops action would have been a measure of pure desperation, to make a last stand for the sake of human honor and nothing else. I didn't often think about what life had been like for people on Earth while I was off-world. It must have been horrible. Terrifying. On Paradise, we dealt with the reality that all our supplies, especially food, had to be brought from Earth by the Kristang, and we'd seen supply shipments getting thin toward the end of my stay there. That had been bad enough. To gradually come to the realization that we were fighting on the wrong side of the war, that our allies were oppressing our home planet, that if UNEF didn't follow the Kristang's every command, the lizards could starve us by halting food shipments. It must have been worse, much worse, on Earth. On Paradise, we had been worried about the survival of the expeditionary force. People on Earth knew the stakes were much higher. Not only the fate of billions of humans, the survival of our entire species could have been at risk. When we went off-world with UNEF, we hadn't known what we were getting into, but we expected it to be bad, very bad. On Earth, people at first considered the Kristang to be saviors, aliens who looked like big ugly lizards, still, our saviors from the invading Ruhar. The Kristang had saved Earth from the Ruhar, so when the Kristang began pushing their weight around, interfering in human affairs, taking territory, taking rare minerals and other materials, at first,
People figure that was the price of supporting the war effort, the price of keeping the Ruha from conquering our home planet and enslaving humanity. When was it that most people on Earth had gotten the uneasy feeling that they'd made a bad bargain, that the Kristang, who by then had total control of the planet, were as bad as we'd imagined the Ruha would be? I didn't know. That was something I should ask the new crew about. They probably wanted to talk about it, needed to talk about it. Needed to talk about it to someone who hadn't lived through it. You're right, Skippy. I should have thought of this. I'm the commander. I'm supposed to know what's on my people's minds. Hey, wait a minute. How do you know what they're thinking?
From listening to them talk, duh. Damn, you're a dope sometimes.
Skippy, you can't do that. People need privacy.
Joe, I can't not do that. I monitor every system on this ship in real time. That includes video and audio inputs. You already know I watch you sleep. I watch you in the shower. I watch you eat.
Yeah, I know. Kinda creepy there, Skippy.
Uh-huh. As if I care what you monkeys look like naked. You're just as ugly with your clothes on.
Fine. Whatever.
What you can't do is tell me or anyone else what you heard people say in private. We must have at least the illusion of privacy aboard the ship. If people know you watch everything they do, that's something they can deal with because you're an alien AI. To most people, you're part of the furniture, an invisible ship system. If people know their fellow crew members or their commander are spying on them, using details of their private lives for gossip, that could destroy morale. Do you understand that?
I don't see what the big deal is, Joe.
Sure, I won't tell you or anyone else what I see or hear.
One question. What if I find out someone is planning to do something stupid that would harm the ship or the mission?
In that case, you do tell me. Only the details I need to hear. Got it?
I think so, yes.
Damn. You monkeys have such complicated social rules for a species so low on the development scale.
I just got to my office, a converted storage closet close to the bridge and combat information center compartments, when Skippy gave me a warning.
Uh-oh, Colonel Joe, heads up. Baldilocks is on his way to see you.
Baldilocks, I laughed.
Who is that?
United States Navy Lieutenant Williams, he explained. Williams commanded our four-man SEAL team. He had a shaved head, hence Skippy's nickname for him. Also, I'd already determined Skippy didn't like him. I knew that because Skippy told me so. Williams and I were not best of friends so far either. My impression was he thought I was completely unqualified for command of such an important mission, that I was unprofessional, uncommitted, too young and inexperienced, not taking my responsibilities seriously, and not much of a soldier. I disagreed with that last one.
Thanks for the warning, Skippy.
I straightened up in my chair and adjusted the iPad to the ergonomically correct position on the table, rather than in my lap where it had been. Williams knocked on the wall beside the door a minute later. The door was permanently recessed into the wall. I wanted to literally have an open door policy.
Colonel Bishop?
At the time, I was pretending to read something on my iPad so he wouldn't know that Skippy had warned me he was coming. Lieutenant Williams, come in, sit down. How you finding the Flying Dutchman?
It's still a bit overwhelming, he admitted.
When we came aboard, I thought we would have somewhat of an advantage, because SEAL teams are accustomed to being deployed aboard ships. I'm finding that doesn't apply much here.
We chatted for 5 minutes, him talking about how amazing it was to be in space, aboard a captured alien starship, me expressing gratefulness for how we'd been able to modify the Dutchman before we left Earth. Some of the ornate decoration in the bridge and CIC compartments had been toned down or painted over. We now had a galley. A place to cook, serve and eat food, real food. And we had cargo holds full of food, enough to last 70 people for years. Maybe the best modification was the beds. Sleeping compartments had been cut away so a full-size bed fit inside. No more trying to sleep curled up in a cramped, Theranin-sized bed. Chang was supposed to come into my office soon for our daily meeting, so I decided to find out what Williams wanted.
What's the issue, Lieutenant? I assume you didn't come in here to chat about the ship.
Sir, I appreciate the experience Sergeant Adams brings, Williams said, and I welcome her advice. However,
She is not familiar with SEAL or Ranger training methods, or training methods of the British SAS, French paratroopers.
You've made your point, Lieutenant, I interrupted him.
Chang was my executive officer, second in command of the ship. Sims was in charge of logistics and third in command. Desai was our chief pilot. Giraud was part of the French paratrooper team. And Adams, at Chang's suggestion, I had assigned to be in charge of training our spec ops people about the ship and the fancy new alien weapons they would be using.
You shouldn't be so cocky, Lieutenant Williams, Skippy added. You weren't even the first choice to lead the SEAL team.
Williams didn't flinch.
Sir, it wasn't clear whether he was addressing that remark to me or to the invisible Skippy.
I know I was the second choice.
Fourth choice, actually, Skippy chimed in helpfully.
Fourth? Williams asked, startled this time.
Lieutenant Jerome Hansen was the first choice, Skippy explained. He turned down the assignment because he did not want to serve under Colonel Bishop. Hansen felt you were too inexperienced for such responsibility, Joe.
Well, that's understandable, I responded. Probably most of the Spec Ops people felt that way. Hell, I felt that way.
Lieutenant Williams here agreed to serve under your command and was originally the second choice. However, he refused the secret conditions your military wanted to impose.
What secret conditions? I looked at Williams sharply.
Williams bit his lip and explained.
The DIA guys wanted me to take over the ship if I felt it was necessary, sir. I refused.
Yep, you did, Skippy added cheerily. And the third guy they offered the assignment to also refused their condition, so they went back to you and dropped their idiot idea of planning a mutiny. That's why, technically, you are the fourth choice to command the SEAL team.
Williams looked back to me.
I didn't know that, sir. I think the mutiny idea was something DIA and, I suspect, CIA wanted.
I appreciate that you didn't come aboard intending to take over my ship, Lieutenant.
My ship. I was now thinking of the Flying Dutchman as mine. When had that happened?
I can't promise that no one else has that idea. We have four other militaries aboard. And I can't vouch for the Ranger team either, sir.
You make a very good point, Lieutenant Williams, Skippy said. Colonel Joe, perhaps I should make an announcement over the intercom and create a demonstration of what will happen if any idiot troop of monkeys tries to take over the ship. How about I close and lock all the doors on the ship and shut off the ventilation? Ooh, and I can kill the artificial gravity also. That will slow down any mutineers.
Skippy, you can't do that.
Huh?
Clearly I can, Joe.
Oh. Sure, I get it. You're right. I'll leave ventilation and gravity on in the bridge and CIC compartments.
That's not my point, Skippy. You can't...
Well, let me say this a different way. You should not do anything like that. If there is a plan for mutiny, I need to handle that myself. Having a shiny beer can do the work for me only makes me look weak as a commander. I don't need any help here, Skippy. This is something you need to keep out of.
You sure about this, Joe?
100%.
You know about sciencey stuff, I know monkeys.
Damn it, I mean, I know humans, people. Stay out of this.
Skippy paused.
I'll make you a deal, Colonel Joe. I will stay out of this unless there is an actual attempted mutiny. If that happens, certain monkeys are going to find out real quick that I am not always a friendly little shiny beer can. Anybody screws with me, they will seriously regret it. Ask the former Theranin crew of this ship if they have any questions about that.
We get your point, Skippy. Loud and clear. A potential mutiny is a subject that I needed to discuss with my command team, Chang, Sims, and Adams. The entire idea of anyone trying to forcefully take over the ship is idiotic. Without Skippy's cooperation, the ship was never getting home.
Williams, it is not my intention for Sergeant Adams to interfere with how you train your SEAL team. She will remain in charge of overall training. You and your team may have studied how to use armored suits and combats. You have no experience with them even in training. Bring your team to the training hold at 1300 hours, and I'll show you what I mean. Arranged along one wall, or I guess aboard a ship, I should have called it a bulkhead, were 10 Kristang-powered armor suits. There were more of them in another compartment. We'd taken 46 suits from the Kristang troop ship in Earth orbit. They weren't all in good condition, so out of the 46 units, we had 42 that were operational. The good news is that the troop ship had equipment for modifying suits, and we now had that equipment aboard the Flying Dutchman. We had been able to adjust most of the suits so that normal-sized humans, now anyone above 5 feet 6 in height, could use a suit.
There hadn't been a whole lot of extra time before we departed Earth orbit, so I didn't have a whole lot of experience with the new suits. I still had way more experience than any of the new crew. In addition to powered armor suits, the Kristang troop ships had provided us with plenty of rifles, ammo, and Zinger anti-aircraft missiles. Except for Theranan combats, we were equipped almost entirely with Kristang military gear, including Z-phones for everyone and night vision gear. The food, of course, all came from Earth. When I arrived at the large cargo hold we used for training, it was 12:50 hours, and both Adams and Williams were already suited up in armor, with only their faceplates open. In the military, if you weren't early, you were late, so of course Williams and his SEAL team had gotten there half an hour early. Along with Adams was Giraud. The French paratrooper leader was checking Williams' suit and explaining its features. On the other side of the cargo hold, Adams was going through exercises, bending over, easily jumping to touch the ceiling that was 10 meters high, and spinning her unloaded Kristang rifle like it was a baton and she was a drum majorette. Generally, she was showing off. I figured she was doing it to intimidate Williams, and from the look on his face, it may have been working. Adams and Giraud showed Williams how the armor suit worked, and he went through a series of familiarization exercises. He was good. Damn good. He caught on much faster than I had back when I put on a suit for the first time. When Adams and Giraud were satisfied that Williams knew enough not to hurt himself, it was time for the show. There was a large circle painted on the floor. Adams announced that the object of the game was like sumo wrestling. Whoever knocked their opponent out of the circle won the match. They took positions opposite each other, toes touching the painted circle, and Giraud announced, "Begin." Williams, knowing Adams had more experience with powered armor, crouched slightly, then launched himself forward. He wasn't going to attempt any advanced hand-to-hand combat. He was going to rely on the suit's speed, power, and mass to knock Adams out of the circle. Adams had a different idea. She stood in place, but as soon as Williams moved forward, a door in the bulkhead behind Adams slammed open, and a combat launched itself across the hold. The combat's feet never touched the floor. It flew through the air in the blink of an eye, crashing into Williams, knocking him to go skidding across the deck. He struggled against the combat, but the Kristang-powered armor was no match for the superior technology of a Theranan combat. Standing in place and controlling the combat through gestures, Adams had the combat gently but firmly pick Williams up like a rag doll and held him against the far bulkhead. "Enough," Giraud declared, and Adams gestured for the combat to release Williams. Williams popped his faceplate open, looked at Adams, and bowed.
"Well played, Sergeant. You did warn me to expect the unexpected out here."
"Everything is unexpected out here," I said. "Do you have any questions, Lieutenant?" To his credit, Williams wasn't insulted, he wasn't angry. He had an enormous grin. Getting familiar with powered armor and combats was going to be a bigger challenge than he thought, and Special Forces people absolutely love challenges.
"No questions at all, Colonel," he said to me.
To his team, he added,
"People, this is going to be fun, so pay attention."
I stayed in the training hold for an hour, taking the opportunity to gain time in a powered suit myself, because it had been weeks since I'd used one. Fortunately, it quickly became familiar again, and I followed along with the SEAL team as Adams and Giraud put them through a series of exercises. It was good, I told myself, for the SEALs to see their commander knew what he was doing. The truth is, I was showing off and I didn't care who knew it. Adams caught my eye a couple times, like when I jumped, touched the ceiling, did a backflip on the way down, and landed perfectly on my feet. That wasn't all skill. The suit's sensors detected the floor and would have pulled me upright to land safely if I hadn't managed to do it on my own. After an hour of fun, I had to get out of the suit and leave because my duty shift on the bridge started in 2 hours and I wanted to grab a snack before then. Out in the corridor, I put my Z-phone earpiece in. "Hey, Skippy, you call me Colonel Joe, you call Sims Major Tammy, you call Chang Colonel Kong." Kong was his given name. "Or King Kong." Chang actually enjoyed being called King Kong. That nickname had totally backfired on Skippy. "You call Lieutenant Williams Baldilocks. You have some sort of nickname for most people, but you only ever call Sergeant Adams Sergeant Adams. Why is that? Her first name is Margaret. Why don't you call her Meg or Peggy or... Hey, how about you call her Sarge Marge?"
"Wow,
I am impressed. I thought I'd seen the depths of your stupidity before, but you're setting a new record low for dumb-dumbness. You have met Sergeant Adams, right?
Duh, I met her before I met you. Oh, that was a rhetorical question. Double duh.
Sarge Marge, huh? Tell me, what do you think would happen if I referred to Sergeant Adams by that quaint nickname?
She'd kick your ass?
Most likely. I seek fun, Joe, not suicide.
Okay. Good talk, then.
Uh-huh, sure. Hey, I noticed you showing off big time in the training hold.
Commander's privilege, Skippy. Besides, I do need to maintain proficiency with powered armor.
Why? You're the commander. You should remain aboard the ship.
No way, no way. Am I staying here all the time, Skippy? And are you absolutely certain there is no possibility that I will never need to use a suit out here?
He sighed.
No, I can't say that for certain, Joe. Fine, you have fun. Just don't hurt yourself. I won't always be there to protect you when you do something stupid.
Got it, Skippy. Thanks.
Chapter 3. After leaving the now dormant wormhole behind, we had set course for another wormhole. Not the next closest wormhole. Unfortunately, the closest wormhole connected in the wrong direction from where we wanted to go. Despite Skippy's joke about setting course for a random blue star, we did have a particular destination planned. We made several Skippy program jumps. Then, when we were in the middle of empty interstellar space, we humans programmed our very first own jump into the nav system by humans. Our very first. My main hope for our first jump was that we didn't blow up the ship. I checked the main bridge display for the vital details of ship status. Although I could see the same data anywhere on the ship with my tablet, it felt more real when I was sitting in the command chair on the bridge. The very bottom left corner of the display now had in small script the designator UNS Flying Dutchman. Skippy must have added that while I wasn't paying attention. The same letters, much larger, were on a new brass plaque above the door to the bridge and CIC compartments. The crew, including me, liked that. It made us sound official. The governments that made up comprised UN Expeditionary Forces Command suddenly decided a few days before we departed that they didn't like the name Flying Dutchman, and various other names were floated for consideration. I got the feeling their public relations people would have liked to run a worldwide naming contest on the internet if they'd had time, and if the nature of the big star carrier hanging in orbit wasn't classified. Navy officers around the world protested that changing a ship's name was traditionally bad luck. Skippy cut the argument short by stating that he liked the name Flying Dutchman, that he controlled all data systems aboard the ship, and that the UN could name our captured alien star carrier the good ship Lollipop for all he cared. It wouldn't change anything. In the frantic days before departure, trying to get the ship loaded with all the people, gear, and supplies we needed, I had no time for BS like carrying what we called the ship. To our merry band of pirates, the ship's name was always going to be the Flying Dutchman anyway. When UNEF dropped the renaming idea, that was one less headache for me. Back home, I am sure the UN still has an international committee of highly paid people studying the issue of our ship's name. Don't worry. They will issue a report long before Earth's sun explodes, probably.
Jump complete, Desai announced from the pilot seat.
Are we clear, Skippy? No unfriendlies in the area? I asked.
You tell me. You say you need to be able to fly this ship on your own, so look at the sensors yourself, Skippy said in a peevish tone.
I wasn't going to argue with him. He was mostly right.
The cold, hard truth was that we did not need to be able to fly the ship on our own. What we did need was some sliver of hope that we might be able to fly the Dutchman on our own after Skippy left us. Clinging to that tiny bit of hope was the difference between a high-risk mission and a suicide mission. The crew, including myself, had signed up for a high-risk mission. Super high-risk, admittedly. Risk of the, if anything goes wrong, we are totally screwed level.
Pilot?
Desai answered more slowly than was optimal, and she knew it.
We jumped to the right place within 700,000 kilometers.
The tone of her voice was not filled with confidence. She let out a breath she'd been holding in.
Yes, confirmed. Jump was successful.
She turned in her chair to look at me and gave me a thumbs up with a weak smile. Desai had programmed the jump herself,
This was the first jump Skippy had not loaded into the autopilot for us. Skippy had grumbled and complained loudly at the delay, then refused to check the numbers for us.
"All I'll tell you is you won't be jumping us into a star," is what he had said.
His grumbling about a delay was understandable. Desai had programmed the jump into the computer yesterday, and we'd then spent the intervening time checking that the program was correct. Three different teams of pilots and scientists had checked the programming, and that was after 2 days of analysis to decide what should be programmed into the Theranan navigation computer. Skippy reluctantly had restored the original Theranan operating system to the navigation system, running it parallel to his own access, making snarky comments about it the whole time. It wasn't the true original operating system, the Theranan ship AI. It was a dumbed-down version that allowed humans access and was simple enough for us to use. Skippy cautioned that if there was a glitch in the system after he left us, he would have no way to debug or fix it, to which I had responded that if there was a glitch anywhere in the navigation system software, that could only be Skippy's fault for screwing up the programming or missing something. That insulted his boundless ego enough for him to declare the software perfect, better than perfect, for he had loaded in his own maintenance and repair subroutine into it. I never let on that I'd played him, so I could use that particular trick again. "Sensors," I called out to the people manning the consoles in the combat information center beyond the glass-like diamond composite bridge walls.
Nothing on the scopes that we can detect, sir," came the answer.
That wasn't reassuring. Without Skippy controlling the data feeds, the bridge and CIC displays didn't contain the helpful color-coding designation for Theranan, Maxulks, Giraptha, Kristang, Ruha, and unknown ships. No matter in this case, there was absolutely nothing on the scopes within a quarter light year. We'd deliberately jumped from the middle of nowhere to the middle of nowhere, and we'd only jumped the distance from Earth's sun to Jupiter, a small test for a first jump. If there had been anything dangerous in the area, Skippy would have told us. He was unhappy, not suicidal. We had jumped only a short distance and still missed the mark by over 500,000 kilometers. No way could we jump anywhere near a planet with that lousy accuracy. We needed to get better, a lot better, or the Dutchman would be spending a lot of time crawling through normal space. And we didn't have the time or fuel for that. We also had a limited supply of fixins for critical cheeseburgers in the galley. Our first jump wasn't an acceptable effort. The crew knew it. "Now, the ship didn't explode," I observed. "We didn't break the jump drive, and we didn't emerge in the middle of a planet or next to a Theranan battle group. Good enough for a first jump. We'll debrief tomorrow morning. In the meantime, Skippy, can you program the next jump? We need to get moving."
"Whoa, whoa, slow down, monkeys.
Have you analyzed the jump drive system? Are the coils calibrated and ready for another jump?" "Pilot," I asked. The drive charge indicator on the bottom of the main display read 87%, good for several regular jumps or one really long jump, with the magical modifications Skippy had made to the Theranan's crappy jump drive.
"It looks like it is okay," Desai answered slowly.
"It looks like it's okay," Skippy scoffed.
"Okay. Such a precise term. I'm completely impressed by your professionalism. Consider that if the jump drive is not okay, another jump could rupture space-time and destroy the aft part of the ship, leaving us stranded here in interstellar space forever. By us, I mean me, because you air breathers will be out of luck once the backup power fails. Yep, I'll be here, alone, surrounded by the dry, dusty corpses of monkeys. My only hope then will be that in 4 billion years, the collision of the Andromeda Galaxy with the Milky Way will throw some solar system's orbit to intersect with wherever I'm drifting at the time. Considering that, I'll ask again, and I'll speak slowly this time. Is the jump drive ready for another jump?"
"You made your point, Skippy," I said with a touch of anger. I didn't appreciate him bullying Desai. "How about this, Mr. Smartass? You need to show us how to analyze the status of the jump drive. We're not doing that now, unless you want another delay. Is the jump drive ready?"
"Of course it is. You never let me have any fun."
"You can find some type of fun that doesn't involve talking about the ship exploding. Program the autopilot for another jump and let's get moving. Also put together a briefing for us tomorrow about what we did wrong and right with that last jump."
"Aye, aye, Captain.
You will be dazzled by the brilliance of my PowerPoint slides.
When we left the now dormant wormhole near Earth, Skippy had programmed a course to bring us to an abandoned crystal.